observing Tengo's apartment from somewhere with a pair of high-powered binoculars. "I am up tonight, in fact," Tengo said. "That intuition of yours is correct. Maybe I drank too much strong green tea." "That is too bad, Mr. Kawana. Wakeful nights often give people useless thoughts. How about it, then? Do you mind talking with me a while?" "As long as it's not about something that makes it harder for me to sleep." Ushikawa burst out laughing. At his end of the line, someplace in this world, his misshapen head shook in its own misshapen way. "Very funny, Mr. Kawana. Of course, what I have to say may not be as comforting as a lullaby, but the subject itself is not so deadly serious as to keep you awake at night, I assure you. It's a simple question of yes or no. The business about the, grant, it's an attractive proposition, don't you think? Have you thought it over? We have to have your final answer now." "I believe I declined the grant quite clearly the last time we talked. I appreciate the offer, but I have everything I need at the moment. I'm not hard-pressed financially, and if possible, I'd like to keep my life going along at its present pace." "Meaning you don't want to be beholden to anyone?" "In a word, yes." "I suppose that is very admirable of you, Mr. Kawana," Ushikawa said with a sound like a light clearing of the throat. "You want to make it on your own. You want to have as little as possible to do with organizations. I understand how you feel, but I'm concerned about you, Mr. Kawana. Look at the world we live in. Anything could happen at any time. So we all need some kind of insurance, something to lean on, a shelter from the wind. I hate to say this, Mr. Kawana, but at the moment you have, exactly nothing that you can lean on. Not one of the people around you can be counted on, it seems to me. All of them would most likely desert you in a pinch. Am I right? You know what they say, better safe than sorry. It's important to insure yourself for when the pinch does come, don't you think? And I'm not just talking about money. Money, ultimately, is just a kind of symbol of something else." "I'm not quite sure what you're getting at," Tengo said. That intuitive sense of distaste he experienced when first meeting Ushikawa was creeping up on him again. "No, of course not. You're still young and healthy. Maybe that's why you don't understand what I'm saying. Let me give you an example. Once you pass a certain age, life becomes nothing more than a process of continual loss. Things that are important to your life begin to slip out of your grasp, one after another, like a comb losing teeth. And the only thing that comes to take their place are worthless imitations. Your physical strength, your hopes, your dreams, your ideals, your convictions, all meaning, or, then again, the people you love. One by one, they fade away. Some announce their departure before they leave, while others just disappear all of a sudden without warning one day. And once you lose them, you can never get them back. Your search for replacements never goes well. It's all very painful as actually being cut with a knife. You will be turning 30 soon, Mr. Kawana, which means that, from now on, you will gradually enter that twilight portion of life. You will be getting older. You are probably beginning to grasp that painful sense that you are losing something, are you not?" Tengo wondered if this man could be dropping hints about Kyoko Yasuda. Perhaps he knew that they had been meeting here once a week, and that recently something had caused her to leave him. "You seem to know a great deal about my private life," Tengo said. "No, not at all," Ushikawa insisted. "I'm just talking about life in general. Really, I know very little about your private life." Tengo remained silent. "Please, Mr. Kawana," Ushikawa said with a sigh. "Be so good as to accept our grant. Frankly speaking, you are in a rather precarious position. We can back you up in a pinch. We can throw you a life preserver. If things go on like this, you might find yourself in an inextricable situation." "An inextricable situation," Tengo said.
"Exactly."
"Can you tell me specifically what kind of situation you mean?" Ushikawa paused momentarily. Then he said, "Believe me, Mr. Kawana, there are things it is better not to know. Certain kinds of knowledge rob people of their sleep. Green tea is no match for these. They might take restful sleep away from you forever. What I want to say to you is this. Think about it this way. It's as if you opened a special spigot and let a special something out before you knew what was happening, and it's having an effect on the people around you, a rather less than desirable effect. Do the little people have anything to do with this? It was a shot in the dark, but it shut Ushikawa up for a while. His was a heavy silence, like a black stone sunk to the bottom of a deep body of water. I want to know the truth, Mr. Ushikawa. Let's stop throwing riddles at each other and talk more concretely. What has happened to her?
Her? I don't know what you mean.
Tengo sighed. This was too delicate a matter to discuss on the phone. I'm sorry, Mr. Kawana, but I'm just a messenger sent by my client. For now, my job is to speak of fundamental matters as indirectly as possible, Ushikawa said circumspectly. I'm sorry if I seem to be deliberately tantalizing you, but I'm only allowed to talk about this in the vaguest terms. And to tell you the truth, my own knowledge of the matter is quite limited. In any case, though, I really don't know anything about her, whoever she might be. You'll have to be a little more specific.
All right, then. Who are the little people?
Again, Mr. Kawana, I don't know anything at all about these little people. Or at least nothing more than they appear in your book, Air Chrysalis. I will tell you this, however. Judging from the drift of your remarks, it seems to me that you have let something out of the bag before you yourself knew what it was all about. That can be awfully dangerous under certain circumstances. My client knows very well just how dangerous it is and what kind of danger it poses, and they have a degree of understanding regarding how to deal with the danger, which is precisely why we have tried to extend a helping hand to you. To put it bluntly, quite bluntly, we have very long, arms. Long and strong.
Who is this client you keep mentioning? Someone connected with Sakigake?
Unfortunately, I have not been granted the authority to divulge any names, Ushikawa said, with what sounded like genuine regret. I can say, however, without going into detail, that they have their own very special power. Formidable power. We can stand behind you. Please understand, this is our final offer. You are free to take it or leave it. Once you make up your mind, however, there is no going back. So please, think about it very carefully. And let me say this, if you are not on their side, regrettably, under certain circumstances, their long arms could, when extended, have certain undesirable, though unintended, effects on you.
What kind of undesirable effects?
Ushikawa did not immediately reply to Tengo's question. Instead, Tengo heard what sounded like the faint sucking of saliva at both sides of Ushikawa's mouth.
I don't know the exact answer to that, Ushikawa said. They haven't told me anything specific, which is why I am speaking in generalities.
So what is it that I supposedly let out of the bag? Tengo asked.
I don't know the answer to that either, Ushikawa said. At the risk of repeating myself, I am nothing but a hired negotiator. By the time the full reservoir of information reaches me, it's squeezed down to a few droplets. All I'm doing is passing on to you exactly what my client has told me to, with the limited authority I have been granted. You may wonder why the client doesn't just contact you directly, which would speed things up, but then why would they use this strange man as an intermediary? But I don't know any better than you do.
Ushikawa cleared his throat and waited for another question, but when there was none, he continued.
Now, Mr. Kawana, you were asking what it is that you let out of the bag, right?
Tengo said yes, that was right.
Well, Mr. Kawana, I'm not sure why exactly, but I can't help wondering if it might be something for which a third party couldn't offer a simple solution. I suspect it's something you would need to go out on your own work and work up a sweat to find out. And it could very well be that after you've gone through all that and reached a point where you've figured out the answer, it's too late.
To me, it seems obvious that you have a very special talent, a superior and beautiful talent, a talent that ordinary people do not possess, which is precisely why your recent accomplishment carries an authority that cannot be easily overlooked, and my client appears to value that talent of yours very highly. That is why we are offering you this grant. Unfortunately, however, sheer talent is not enough, and depending upon how you look at it, possessing an outstanding talent that is not sufficient may be more dangerous than possessing nothing at all. That is my impression, however vague, of the recent matter.
So what you are saying, then, is that your client has sufficient knowledge and ability to tell about such things?
I really can't say about that, don't you think? I mean, nobody can ever declare whether such qualities are sufficient. Why do they need me?
If I may use the analogy of epidemic, you people may be playing the role of, pardon me, the main carriers of a disease.
You people, Tengo said. Are you talking about Eriko Fukada and me?
Ushikawa did not answer the question.
If I may use a classical analogy, you people here might have opened Pandora's box and let loose all kinds of things in the world. This seems to be what my client thinks you've done, judging from my own impressions. The two of you may have joined forces by accident, but you turned out to be a far more powerful team than you ever imagined. Each of you was able to make up for what the other lacked.
But that's not a crime in any legal sense.
That is true. It is not, of course, a crime in any legal sense, or in any this-world sense. If I may be allowed to quote from George Orwell's great classic, however, or rather from his novel as a great source of quotations, it is very close to what he called a thought crime. By an odd coincidence, this year just happens to be 1984. Shall we call it a stroke of fate? But I seem to have been talking a bit too much tonight, Mr. Kawana, and most of what I've been saying is nothing but my own clumsy guesswork, pure speculation, without any firm evidence to support it. Because you asked, I have given you my general impressions, that is all.
Ushikawa fell silent, and Tengo started thinking,
his own clumsy guesswork? How much of what this man is saying can I believe?
Oh, well, I'll have to be calling it a day, Ushikawa said. It's such an important matter, I'll give you a little more time. Just a little. The clock is counting off the time. Tick-tock, tick-tock, without a break. Please consider our offer carefully once more. I'll probably be getting in touch with you again soon. Good night, then. I'm glad we had a chance to talk. I hope you will be able to sleep well, Mr. Kawana.
Ushikawa hung up. Tengo stared at the dead receiver in his hand for a while, the way a farmer stares at a withered vegetable he has picked up from his drought-racked field. These days, a lot of people were hanging up on Tengo. As he had imagined, restful sleep paid Tengo no visits that night, until the pale light of dawn began coloring the curtains and the tough city crows woke to begin their day's work. Tengo sat on the floor, leaning against the wall, and thinking about his girlfriend and about the long, strong arms reaching toward him from some unknown place. Such thoughts, however, carried him nowhere. They merely circled aimlessly around the same spot. Tengo looked around and heaved a sigh and realized that he was absolutely alone. Ushikawa had been right. He had nothing and no one to lean on.
Chapter 7 Aomame, Where You Are About to Set Foot. With its high ceiling and muted lighting, the capacious lobby of the Hotel Okura's main building seemed like a huge, stylish cave. Against the cave walls, like the sighing of a disemboweled animal, bounced the muted conversations of people seated on the lobby's sofas. The floor's thick, soft carpeting could have been primeval moss on a far northern island. It absorbed the sound of footsteps into its endless span of accumulated time. The men and women crossing and recrossing the lobby looked like ghosts tied in place by some ancient curse, doomed to the endless repetition of their assigned roles. Men were armored in tight-fitting business suits. Slim young women were swathed in chic black dresses, here to attend a ceremony in one of the hotel's mini reception rooms. They wore small but expensive accessories, like vampire finches in search of blood, longing for a hint of light they could reflect. A large foreign couple loomed like an old king and queen past their prime, resting their tired bodies on thrones in the corner. In this place, so full of legend and suggestion, Almame was truly out of place. With her pale blue cotton pants, simple white blouse, white sneakers, and blue Nike gym bag. She probably looked like a babysitter sent by her agency to work for a hotel guest, she thought, as she killed time sitting in a big easy chair. Oh well, I'm not here for socializing. Sitting there, she sensed that someone was watching her. But try as she might to scan the area, she could not find anyone who seemed to be focused on her. Never mind, she told herself. Let them look all they want. When the hands of her watch hit 6:50, Almame stood up and went to the ladies' room carrying her gym bag. She washed her hands with soap and water and checked once more to make sure there were no problems with her appearance. Then, facing the large, clear mirror, she took several deep breaths. This was a spacious restroom, and she was the only one in it. It might be even bigger than her whole apartment. "This is going to be my last job," she said in a low voice to the mirror. "Once I carry this off, I disappear. Poof. Like a ghost. I'm here now, but not tomorrow. In a few days, I'll have a different name and a different face." She returned to the lobby and took her seat again, setting the gym bag on the table next to her. In the bag was a small automatic pistol with 7 bullets and a sharp needle made for thrusting into the back of a man's neck. "I've got to calm down," she told herself. "This job is important, and it's my last. I have to be the usual cool, tough Almame." But she could not shake off the awareness that she was not in a normal state. Her breathing was strangely labored, and the heightened speed of her heartbeat concerned her. A film of sweat moistened her armpits. Her skin was tingling. "I'm not just tense, though. I'm having a premonition of something. And the premonition is giving me a warning. It keeps knocking on the door of my mind. It's telling me it's still not too late. Get out of here now and forget all this." Almame wanted to heed the warning if she could, abandon everything and turn her back on this hotel lobby. There was something ominous here, the lingering presence of circuitous death, a slow, quiet, but inescapable death. "But I can't just run away with my tail between my legs. That's not the Almame way to live." It was a long 10 minutes. Time refused to move ahead. She stayed on the sofa, trying to get her breathing under control. The lobby ghosts kept spouting their hollow reverberations. People drifted silently over the thick carpet, like souls groping for their eternal resting places. The only actual noise to reach her ears now and then was the clinking of a coffee set on a tray whenever a waitress passed by. But even that sound contained a dubious secondary sound within it. Things were not heading in a good direction. "If I'm already this tense, I won't be able to do a thing when the time comes." Almame closed her eyes and almost by reflex intoned a prayer, the one that she had been taught to recite before every meal from as long ago as she could remember. That had been a long, long time ago, but she remembered every word with perfect clarity. "O Lord in heaven, may thy name be praised in utmost purity forever and ever, and may thy kingdom come to us. Please forgive our many sins, and bestow thy blessings upon our humble pathways. Amen. However grudgingly, Almamah had to admit that this prayer, which had given her nothing but pain in the past, now provided a source of support. The sound of the words calmed her nerves, stopped her fears at the doorway, and helped her breathing to quiet down. She pressed her fingers against her eyelids and repeated the prayer to herself over and over. "Miss Almamah, I believe," a man said close by. It was the voice of a young man. Almamah opened her eyes, slowly raised her head, and looked at the owner of the voice. Two young men were standing in front of her. Both wore the same kind of dark suit. Judging by the fabric and cut, these were not expensive clothes, probably bought right off the rack at a discount store. They didn't quite fit in every detail, but they were admirably free of wrinkles. Perhaps the men pressed them every time they put them on. Neither man wore a tie. One had his white shirt buttoned all the way to the top, while the other wore a kind of gray crewneck t-shirt under his suit jacket. They had on the plainest black shoes possible. The man in the white shirt must have been a good 6 feet tall, and he wore his hair in a ponytail. He had long eyebrows, the ends of which turned up at a distinct angle like a line graph. His face was serene, with well-balanced features that could have belonged to an actor. The other man must have been 5'5" and had a buzz cut and a snub nose. A tiny beard grew at the tip of his chin, like a mistakenly applied shadow, and there was a small scar by his right eye. Both men were slim, with sunken cheeks and tanned faces. There was not an ounce of fat to be seen on either of them, and judging from the spread of their suits' shoulders, there were some serious muscles underneath. They were probably in their mid to late 20s. The look in their eyes was deep and sharp, and the eyeballs moved no more than necessary, as with animals on the hunt. As if by reflex, Almamah stood up from her chair and looked at her watch. The hands pointed to 7 o'clock exactly, right on time. "Yes, I am Almamah." Neither man displayed any expression. They did a swift examination of Almamah's attire and looked at the blue gym bag next to her. "Is this all you brought with you?" Buzzcut asked. "Yes, this is it," Almamah said. "That's fine. Let's go, then. Are you ready?" Buzzcut asked. Ponytail said nothing as he kept his eyes on Almamah. "Yes, of course," Almamah said. She guessed that the shorter man was somewhat older than the other one and the leader of the two. Buzzcut went ahead with leisurely steps, crossing the lobby toward the elevators. Almamah followed him, gym bag in hand. Ponytail followed about 6 feet behind her. This meant she was sandwiched between them. "They know what they're doing," she thought. They walked with erect posture, their gait strong and precise. The dowager has said they both practice karate. Almamah knew from her martial arts training that in face-to-face confrontation with these two, there was probably no way she could win. But she did not sense from these men the kind of overpowering menace that Tamaru projected. Defeating them was not entirely out of the question. The first thing she would have to do in hand-to-hand combat would be to render Buzzcut powerless. He called the shots. If Ponytail was her only opponent, she could manage to survive and escape. The three of them boarded the elevator, and Ponytail pushed the button for the 7th floor. Buzzcut stood next to Almamah, and Ponytail stood in the corner, facing them at an angle. They did all this wordlessly, systematically, like a second baseman and shortstop who live to make double plays. In the midst of such thoughts, it suddenly dawned on Almamah that her breathing and heartbeat had returned to their normal rhythms. "Nothing to worry about," she thought. I'm my usual self, the cool, tough Amame. Everything will probably go well. No more bad premonitions. The elevator door opened soundlessly. Ponytail kept the door open button depressed, while Buzzcut stepped out, followed by Amame, and then he released the button and left the elevator. Buzzcut led the way down the corridor, Amame followed, and Ponytail continued playing rear guard. The broad corridor was totally deserted, perfectly silent and perfectly clean, well cared for in every detail, befitting a first-class hotel. No trays of used room service dishes parked in front of doors. No cigarette butts in the ashtray outside the elevator. The fragrance of fresh-cut flowers wafting from well-placed vases. They turned several corners and came to a stop in front of a door. Ponytail knocked twice and then, without waiting for an answer, opened the door with the key card. He stepped inside, looked around to make sure there was nothing wrong, and gave Buzzcut a curt nod. "Please," Buzzcut said to Amame dryly. Amame walked in. Buzzcut came in after her and closed the door, locking it from the inside with a chain. The room was a big one, no ordinary hotel room. It was outfitted with a large set of reception room furniture and an office desk. The television set and refrigerator were also full size. This was clearly the living area of a special suite. The window provided a sweeping view of Tokyo at night. It had to be an expensive room. Buzzcut checked his watch and urged Amame to sit on the sofa. She did as she was told and set her blue gym bag next to her.
"Will you be changing clothes?"
Buzzcut asked. "If possible," Amame said, "I'd prefer to change into workout clothes."
Buzzcut nodded. "First, we'll have to do a search, if you don't mind. Sorry, but it's part of our job."
"That's fine. Search all you want," Amame said. There was no hint of tension in her voice. If anything, there was a perceptible touch of amusement at their neurotic attention to detail. Ponytail came over to Amame and did a body search to make sure she was not carrying anything suspicious. All she had on was a pair of thin cotton pants and a blouse. It didn't take a search to know there could be nothing hidden under those. He was just going through the motions. His hands seemed tense and stiff. It would have been hard to compliment him on his skill at this. He probably had little experience at doing body searches on women. Buzzcut watched him work, leaning against the desk. When the body search was over, Amame opened her gym bag for him. Inside were a thin summer cardigan, a matching jersey top and bottom for work, and two towels, one large and one small. A simple makeup set and a paperback. There was also a small beaded purse containing a wallet, a change purse, and a keyring. Amame handed each item to Ponytail. Finally, she took out a black vinyl pouch and unzipped it. Inside was a change of underwear and a few tampons and sanitary napkins. "I sweat when I work, so I need to have a change of clothes," Amame said. She took out matching lace-trimmed bra and panties and started to spread them out for Ponytail to see. He blushed slightly and gave several quick nods as if to say, "All right, I've seen enough." Amame began to suspect that this man could not speak at all. With unhurried movements, Amame returned her underthings and sanitary products to the pouch, zipped it closed, and replaced it in the bag. "These guys are amateurs," she thought. "What kind of bodyguard blushes at the sight of cute lingerie and a few tampons? If Tamaru had been doing this job, he would have searched Snow White down to the hairs of her crotch. He would have examined the bottom of that pouch if it meant digging through a warehouse's worth of bras, camisoles, and panties. Things like that are nothing but rags to him. Well, true, he's as gay as they come. At the very least, he would have picked up the pouch to check its weight. And then he would have been sure to find the heckler and coke wrapped in a handkerchief
and weighing in at some 500 grams, and the small homemade ice pick in its hard case. These guys are amateurs. They may have some skill at karate, and they may have vowed absolute loyalty to their leader, but they're nothing but a couple of amateurs, just as the Dowager predicted. Ah Mama had assumed they wouldn't go through a pouch stuffed with women's things, and she had been right. It had been a gamble, of course, but she had not gone so far as to think about what she would do if the gamble hadn't paid off. About all she could have done in that case was pray. But she knew this much. Prayer works. Ah Mame went into the suite's large powder room and changed into her jersey outfit, folding her blouse and cotton pants and placing them in the bag. Next, she checked to see that her hair was pinned tightly in place. Then she sprayed her mouth with a breath freshener. She took the Heckler & Koch out of the pouch, and after flushing the toilet to mask the sound, she pulled back the slide to send a bullet into the chamber. Now all she would have to do was release the safety. Finally, she moved the case with the ice pick to the top of the bag, where she could have immediate access to it. Once she had finished with these preparations, she faced the mirror and relaxed her tensed expression. Fine. I've kept my cool so far. Coming out of the powder room, Ah Mama found Buzzcut standing at attention, with his back to her, speaking at low volume into a telephone. When he saw her, he cut his call short, quietly hung up the receiver, and gave her a once-over in her jersey outfit. "All set?" he asked. "Whenever you are," Ah Mama said. "First I have a request to make," Buzzcut said. Ah Mama gave him a token smile. "That you not say a word about tonight to anyone," Buzzcut said. He paused a moment so that his message could sink in. It was as if he had scattered water on dry earth and was waiting for it to be absorbed and disappear. She watched him the whole time without saying anything. Buzzcut continued. "Pardon me if this sounds crass, but we are planning to offer you generous remuneration, and we may be requesting your services from time to time in the future. So we would like to ask you to forget anything and everything that happens here tonight. Whatever you see or hear. Everything." "As you know," Ah Mama said, adopting a somewhat frosty tone, "my work involves people's bodies, so I believe I am well versed in the ways of professional confidentiality. No information of any kind regarding an individual's body will leave this room. If that is what concerns you, I can assure you there is no need to worry." "Excellent. That is what we wanted to hear," Buzzcut said. "But let me just add that we would appreciate it if you would view this as a case that goes beyond professional confidentiality in the most general sense. Where you are about to set foot is, so to speak, a sacred space."
"A sacred space?"
"It may sound a bit much, but believe me, it is no exaggeration. The one you are about to lay eyes on and to place your hands upon is a sacred person. There is no other appropriate way to put it."
Ah Mama nodded, saying nothing. This was no time for remarks from her.
Buzzcut said, "We took the liberty of running a background check on you. I hope you're not offended, but it was something we had to do. We have our reasons for taking every precaution."
Ah Mama stole a glance at Ponytail as she listened. He was sitting motionless in a chair beside the door, his back perfectly straight, hands on his knees, chin pulled back. He could have been posing for a photo. His eyes were locked on her the whole time. Buzzcut looked down at his feet as if to check how worn out his black shoes might be, then raised his face and looked at Ah Mame again.
"In short, we found no problems, which is why we have asked you to come today. You have a reputation as a talented instructor, and in fact people think very highly of you."
"Thank you very much," Ah Mame said.
I understand you used to be a Society of Witnesses believer. Is that true?
Yes, it is. Both of my parents were believers, and they naturally made me one too, from the time I was born. I didn't choose it for myself, and I left the religion a long time ago.
I wonder if their investigation turned up the fact that Ayumi and I used to go out manhunting in Roppongi.
Oh, well, it doesn't make any difference. If they did find out, it obviously didn't bother them. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here now.
We know about that, too, Buzzcut said. But you did live in faith at one time in your life. That especially impressionable time of early childhood. So I assume you have a good idea of what I mean when I speak of something as sacred. In any religion, the sacred lies at the very root of faith. We must never tread upon that world. There is a sacred religion into which we dare not stray. The first step of all faith is to recognize its existence, accept it, and revere it absolutely. You do understand what I am trying to say, don't you?
I think so, Almama said, though whether I accept it or not is another matter.
Of course, Buzzcut said. Of course there is no need for you to accept it. It is our faith, not yours. But transcending the question of belief or non-belief, you are likely to witness special things. A being who is by no means ordinary.
Almama kept silent. A being who is by no means ordinary.
Buzzcut narrowed his eyes for a time, gauging the meaning of Almama's silence. Then, speaking unhurriedly, he said,
Whatever you happen to witness today, you must not mention it to anyone on the outside. For that would cause an ineradicable defilement of the holiness, as if a clear, beautiful pond were polluted by a foreign body. Whatever the world at large might think, or the laws of this world might stipulate, that is how we feel about it. If we can count on you, and if you will keep your promise, we can, as I said before, provide you with generous remuneration.
I see, Almama said.
We are a small religious body, but we have strong hearts and long arms, Buzzcut said.
You have long arms, Almama thought.
I guess I'll be testing to find out just how long they are.
Leaning against the desk with his arms folded, Buzzcut studied Almama, as if checking to see whether a picture hanging on the wall was crooked or straight. Ponytail remained motionless, never once taking his eyes off of Almama. Buzzcut checked his watch.
Let's go then, he said.
He cleared his throat once, then moved slowly across the room, with the careful steps of a pilgrim crossing the surface of a lake. He gave two soft knocks on the door to the connecting room, and without waiting for a response, pulled the door open, gave a slight bow, and entered. Almama followed, carrying the gym bag. Sinking step after careful step into the deep carpet, she made sure that her breathing was under control. Her finger was cocked and ready to pull the trigger of the pistol in her imagination.
Nothing to worry about. I'm the same as always. But still, Almama was afraid. A chunk of ice was stuck to her spine. Ice that showed no sign of melting. I'm cool, calm, and deep down, afraid. We must never tread upon that world. There is a sacred region into which we dare not stray, Buzzcut had said. Almama knew what he meant by that. She herself had once lived in a world that placed such a region at its core. In fact, I might still be living in that world. I just may not be aware of it.
Almama soundlessly repeated the words of her prayer with her lips. Then she took one deep breath, made up her mind, and walked into the next room.
Chapter 8. Tengo. Time for the cats to come. Tengo spent the next week or more in a strange silence. One night, the man named Yasuda had called to tell Tengo that his wife had been lost and would never visit Tengo again. An hour later, Ushikawa had called to tell him that Tengo and Fukairi were functioning together as a carrier of a thought crime epidemic. Each caller had conveyed to Tengo a message containing, he could only believe that it did contain, a deep meaning, the way a toga-clad Roman would mount a platform in the middle of the forum to make a proclamation to concerned citizens. And once each man had spoken his piece, he had hung up on Tengo. Not one person had contacted Tengo since those two nighttime calls. There were no phone calls, no letters, no knocks on the door, no carrier pigeons. Neither Komatsu nor Professor Ebisuno, nor Fukairi, nor Kyoko Yasuda had anything at all they needed to convey to Tengo. And Tengo felt as if he had lost all interest in those people. Nor was it just them. He seemed to have lost interest in anything at all. He didn't care about the sales of Air Chrysalis, or what its author, Fukairi, might be doing now, or what was happening with Komatsu's scheme, or whether Professor Ebisuno's coolly conceived plan was progressing well, or how close the media had come to sniffing out the truth, or what kind of moves Sakigake might be making. If the boat they were all riding in was plunging over the falls upside down, there was nothing to do but fall with it. Tengo could struggle all he wanted to at this point, and it would do nothing to change the flow of the river. He was, of course, worried about Kyoko Yasuda. He had no real idea what was happening to her, but he would spare no effort to help her if he could. Whatever problems she was facing at the moment, however, were out of his reach. There was nothing he could do. He stopped reading the papers. The world was moving ahead in a direction unconnected with him. Apathy enveloped him, as if it were his own personal haze. He was so sick of seeing the piles of Air Chrysalis on display that he stopped going to bookstores. He would travel in a straight line from home to the school and back. Most people were enjoying summer vacation, but the cram schools had summer courses which kept him busier than ever. He welcomed his schedule. At least while he was lecturing, he didn't have to think about anything but mathematics. He gave up on writing his novel, too. He might sit at his desk, switch on the word processor, and watch the screen light up, but he couldn't find the motivation to write. Whenever he tried to think of anything, snatches of his conversations with Kyoko Yasuda's husband or with Ushikawa would come to mind. He couldn't concentrate on his novel. "My wife is irretrievably lost. She can no longer visit your home in any form." That was what Kyoko Yasuda's husband had said. If I may use a classical analogy here, you people might have opened Pandora's box and let loose all kinds of things in the world. The two of you may have joined forces by accident, but you turned out to be a far more powerful team than you ever imagined. Each of you was able to make up for what the other lacked. So said Ushikawa. Both seemed to be trying to say the same thing. Tengo had unleashed some kind of power before fully comprehending it himself, and it was having a real impact, probably not a desirable impact, on the world around him. Tengo turned off the word processor, sat down on the floor, and stared at the telephone. He needed more hints, more pieces of the puzzle, but no one would give him those. Kindness was one of the things presently, or permanently, in short supply in the world. He thought about phoning someone, Komatsu or Professor Ebisuno or Ushikawa, but he couldn't make himself actually do it. He had had enough of their inscrutable, deliberately cryptic pronouncements. If he sought a hint concerning one riddle, all they would give him was another riddle. He couldn't keep up the game forever. Fukairi and Tengo were a powerful team. That's all they needed to say. Tengo and Fukairi, like Sonny and Cher. The beat goes on. Day after day went by. Finally, Tengo grew tired of staying holed up in his apartment, waiting for something to happen. He shoved his wallet and a paperback into his pockets, put on a baseball cap and sunglasses, and went out, walking with decisive strides as far as Koenji, the nearby station. There he showed his pass and boarded the Chuo Line inbound rapid service train. The car was empty. He had nothing planned that day. Wherever he went and whatever he did, or didn't do, was entirely up to him.
It was 10 o'clock on a windless summer morning, and the sun was beating down. Wondering if one of Ushikawa's researchers might be following him, he paid special attention on the way to the station, stopping suddenly to glance behind him. But there was no sign of anyone suspicious. At the station, he purposely went to the wrong platform, and then, pretending to change his mind all of a sudden, he dashed down the stairs and went to the platform for the trains headed in the other direction. But no one else seemed to take those same maneuvers. He must be having a typical delusion of being pursued. Of course no one was following him. Not even Tengo knew where he was going or what he was about to do. He himself was the one who most wanted to watch his own forthcoming actions from a distance. The train he had boarded passed Shinjuku, Yotsuya, Ochinomitsu, and arrived at Tokyo Central Station, the end of the line. Everyone got off, and he followed suit. Then he sat on a bench and gave some thought to where he ought to go. "I'm in downtown Tokyo now," Tengo thought. "I have nothing planned all day. I can go anywhere I decide to. The day looks as if it's going to be a hot one. I could go to the seashore." He raised his head and looked at the platform guide. At that point, he suddenly realized what he had been doing all along. He tried shaking his head a few times, but the idea that had struck him would not go away. He had probably made up his mind unconsciously from the moment he boarded the inbound Chuo line train at his station in Koenji. He heaved a sigh, stood up from the bench, went down the platform stairs, and headed for the Sobu line platform. On the way, he asked a station employee for the fastest connection to Chikura, and the man flipped through the pages of a thick volume of train schedules. He could take the 11:30 special express train to Tateyama, transfer there to a local, and he would arrive at Chikura shortly after 2 o'clock. He bought a Tokyo-Chikura round-trip ticket and a reserved seat on the express train. Then he went to a restaurant in the station and ordered rice and curry and a salad. He killed time after the meal by drinking a cup of thin coffee. Going to see his father was a depressing prospect. He had never much liked the man, and his father probably had no special love for him either. Tengo had no idea if his father had any desire to see him. His father had retired from NHK 4 years earlier, and soon afterward entered a sanatorium in Chikura that specialized in care for patients with cognitive disorders. Tengo had visited him there no more than twice before. The first time, just after the father entered the facility, when an administrative procedural problem had required Tengo as the only relative to travel out there. The second time had involved a pressing administrative matter as well. 2 times. That was it. The sanatorium stood on a large plot of land across the road from the shoreline. Originally the country villa of a wealthy family connected with one of the pre-war zaibatsu, large, influential, family-controlled, financial, industrial monopolies. It had been bought as a life insurance company's welfare facility, and more recently converted into a sanatorium primarily for the treatment of people with cognitive disorders. To an outside observer, it appeared to be an odd combination of elegant old wooden buildings and new 3-story reinforced concrete buildings. The air there was fresh, however, and aside from the roar of the surf, it was always quiet. One could walk along the shore on days when the wind was not too strong. An imposing pine grove lined the garden as a windbreak, and the medical facilities were excellent. With his health insurance, retirement bonus, savings, and pension, Tengo's father could probably spend the rest of his life there quite comfortably, all because he had been lucky enough to be hired as a full-time employee of NHK. He might not be able to leave behind any sizable inheritance, but at least he could be taken care of, for which Tengo was tremendously grateful. Whether or not the man was his true biological father, Tengo had no intention of taking anything from him or giving him anything. They were 2 separate human beings who had come from and were heading toward entirely different places. By chance, they had spent some years of life together. That was all. It was a shame that things had come to that, Tengo believed, but there was absolutely nothing he could do about it. Tengo knew that the time had come for him to visit his father again. He didn't much like the idea, and he would have preferred to take a U-turn and go straight back to his apartment. But he already had his round-trip and express train tickets in his pocket. He was all set to go. He left the table, paid his bill, and went to the platform to wait for the Tateyama express train to arrive. He scanned his surroundings once more, but saw no likely researchers in the area. His only fellow passengers were happy-looking families heading out for a few days at the beach. He took off his sunglasses, shoved them into a pocket, and readjusted his baseball cap. "Who gives a damn?" he thought. "Let them spy on me all they want. I'm going to a seaside town in Chiba to see my father, who is suffering from dementia. He might remember his son, or then again he might not. His memory was already pretty shaky last time. It's probably gotten worse since then. Cognitive disorders move ahead, never back, or so I've been told. They're like gears that can only move in one direction." When the train left Tokyo Station, Tengo took out the paperback he had brought along and started reading it. It was an anthology of short stories on the theme of travel, and included one tale about a young man who journeyed to a town ruled by cats. Town of Cats was the title. It was a fantastical piece by a German writer with whom he was not familiar. According to the book's editorial note, the story had been written in the period between the two world wars. Carrying a single bag, the young man is traveling alone at his whim, with no particular destination in mind. He goes by train and gets off at any stop that arouses his interest. He takes a room, sees the sights, and stays as long as he likes. When he has had enough, he boards another train. He spends every vacation this way. One day he sees a lovely river from the train window. Gentle green hills line the meandering stream, and below them lies a quiet-looking, pretty little town with an old stone bridge over the river. The scene attracts him. Tasty river fish should be available in a place like this. The train stops at the station, and the young man steps down with his bag. No one else gets off there. As soon as he alights, the train departs. No workers man the station, which must see very little activity. The young man crosses the stone bridge and walks into the town. It is utterly still, with no one to be seen. All the shops are shuttered, the town hall deserted. No one occupies the desk at the town's only hotel. He rings the bell, but no one comes out. The place seems totally uninhabited. Perhaps all the people are off napping somewhere. But it is only 10:30 in the morning, way too early for that. Perhaps something caused all the people to abandon the town. In any case, the next train will not come until the following morning, so he has no choice but to spend the night here. He wanders around the town to kill time. In fact, however, this is a town of cats. When the sun starts to go down, many cats cross the bridge into town. Cats of all different kinds and colors. They are much larger than ordinary cats, but they are still cats. The young man is shocked to see this spectacle. He rushes into the bell tower in the center of town and climbs to the top to hide. The cats go about their business, raising the shop shutters or seating themselves at their town hall desks to start their day's work. Soon, still more cats come, crossing the bridge into town like the others. They enter the shops to buy things, or go to the town hall to handle administrative matters, or have a meal at the hotel restaurant, or drink beer at the tavern and sing lively cat songs. One plays a concertina, and others dance to the music. Because cats can see in the dark, they need almost no lights. But that particular night, the glow of the full moon floods the town, enabling the young man to see every detail from his perch in the bell tower. When dawn approaches, the cats close up shop, finish their work or official business, and swarm back across the bridge to where they came from. By the time the sun comes up, the cats are gone, and the town is deserted again. The young man climbs down, picks one of the hotel beds for himself, and goes to sleep. When he gets hungry, he eats the bread and cooked fish left in the hotel kitchen. When darkness approaches, he hides in the top of the bell tower again and observes the cats' activities until dawn. Trains stop at the station before noon and before evening. If he took the morning train, he could continue his journey, and if he took the afternoon train, he could go back where he came from. No passengers alight at the station, and no one boards here either. Still, the trains stop at the station for exactly 1 minute as scheduled and pull out again. He could take one of the trains and leave the creepy cat town behind, but he doesn't. Being young, he has a lively curiosity and boundless ambition, and is ready for adventure. He wants to see more of the strange spectacle of the cat town. If possible, he wants to find out when and how it became a town of cats, how the town is organized, and what the cats are doing there. He is probably the only human being who has ever seen this strange sight. On the night of the third day, a hubbub breaks out in the square below the bell tower. "Hey, do you smell something human?" one of the cats says. "Now that you mention it, I thought there was a funny smell the past few days," another chimes in, twitching his nose. "Me too," says yet another cat. "That's weird. There shouldn't be any humans here," someone adds. "No, of course not. There's no way a human could get into this town of cats. Still, that smell of theirs is definitely here." The cats form into groups and search the town from top to bottom, like vigilante bands. Cats have an excellent sense of smell when they want to use it, so it takes them very little time to discover that the bell tower is the source of the smell. The young man hears their soft paws padding their way up the stairs. "That's it. They've got me," he thinks. His smell seems to have aroused the cats to anger. They have big, sharp claws and white fangs. Humans are not supposed to set foot in this town. He has no idea what terrible fate awaits him if he is discovered, but he is sure they will never let him leave the town alive now that he has learned their secret. Three cats climb to the top of the bell tower and sniff the air. "Strange," one cat says, twitching his whiskers. "I smell a human, but there's no one here." "It is strange," says a second cat. "But there is definitely no one here. Let's look somewhere else." "I don't get it, though." The three cats cock their heads, puzzled, then retreat down the stairs. The young man hears their footsteps going down and fading into the dark of night. He breathes a sigh of relief, but he doesn't get it either. He was literally nose to nose with the cats in this small space. There was no way they could have missed him. But for some reason, they did not see him. He brings his hand to his eyes and can see it perfectly well. It hasn't turned transparent. Strange. In any case, though, when morning comes, he knows he should go to the station and take the train away from this town. Staying here would be too dangerous. His luck can't last forever. The next day, however, the morning train does not stop at the station. He watches it pass by without slowing down. The afternoon train does the same. He can even see the engineer seated at the controls. The passengers' faces, too, are visible through the windows. But the train shows no sign of stopping. It is as though people cannot see the young man waiting for a train, or even see the station itself. Once the afternoon train disappears down the track, the place grows quieter than ever. The sun begins to sink. It is time for the cats to come. He knows that he is irretrievably lost. This is no town of cats, he finally realizes. It is the place where he is meant to be lost. It is a place not of this world that has been prepared especially for him. And never again, for all eternity, will the train stop at the station to bring him back to his original world. Tengo read the story twice. The phrase, "the place where he is meant to be lost," attracted his attention. He closed the book and let his eyes wander aimlessly across the drab coastal industrial scene passing by the train window. The flame of an oil refinery, the gigantic gas tanks, the squat but equally gigantic smokestacks shaped like long-range cannons, the line of tractor trailers and tank trucks moving down the road. It was a scene remote from Town of Cats, but it had its own sense of fantasy about it, as though it were the netherworld supporting urban life from below. Soon afterward, Tengo closed his eyes and imagined Kyoko Yasuda closed up in her own lost place, where there were no trains or telephones or mail. During the day there was nothing but absolute loneliness, and with night came the cat's relentless searching, the cycle repeating itself with no apparent end. Apparently he had drifted off to sleep in his seat, not a long nap, but a deep one. He woke covered in sweat. The train was moving along the southern coastline of the Boso Peninsula in midsummer. He left the express train in Tateyama, transferred to a local, and went as far as Chikura. Stepping from the train, he caught a whiff of the old familiar smell of the seashore. Everyone on the street was darkly tanned. He took a cab from the station to the sanatorium. At the reception desk, he gave his name and his father's name. The middle-aged nurse at the desk asked, "Have you by any chance notified us of your intention to visit today?" There was a hard edge to her voice. A small woman, she wore metal-frame glasses, and her short hair had a touch of gray. The ring on her stubby ring finger might have been bought as part of a matching set with the glasses. Her name tag said, "Tamura." "No, it just occurred to me to come this morning, and I hopped on a train," Tengo answered honestly. The nurse gave him a look of mild disgust. Then she said,
Visitors are supposed to notify us before they arrive to see a patient. We have our schedules to keep, and the wishes of the patient must also be taken into account.
I'm sorry, I didn't know.
When was your last visit?